Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding, Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session.
All right, go ahead and have a seat. Good morning. My understanding is we have the University of Wisconsin Law School here. Oh. If you could stand up, we'd like to properly acknowledge you. Wow, good group. It's nice to have you here today. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I think, if my understanding is correct, piece of paper is one thing, but I've been told another thing. You're not staying to meet with a justice? Okay. Oh, well, class is important when you're in law school, so lesson to all of us, right? Okay, nice to have you here. Go ahead and have a seat. Case this morning, State versus BW, 22 AP 1329. I start out with counsel's appearances. All right, good morning, all of you. I have 25 minutes followed by 15 minutes and 15 minutes and back for 5 minutes in rebuttal. All right, with that understanding, let's proceed.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. As I said, my name is Chris Sovic. I'm from the Wisconsin State Public Defender's Office, and I represent BW, the father in this termination of parental rights, or TPR, proceedings. In this case, BW entered a no-contest plea during the grounds, giving up his valuable right to challenge the grounds at a trial, at a jury trial in this matter. The first question this appeal raises, and the question that this court must answer, is whether BW made a prima facie showing that the circuit court's plea colloquy was defective in this matter when he entered his plea. Because I do believe that BW made a prima facie case that the court's plea colloquy was defective, I do ask this court to remand the case for an evidentiary hearing. The circuit court's plea colloquy was defective in this matter because it miscommunicated to BW that there was a burden of proof placed on the state at disposition when there, in fact, is not a burden of proof placed on the state at disposition in TPR matters. More specifically,
counsel, your statement in your petition for review is essentially, and for which we made a decision to take this case, is essentially as you articulated here.
Sure.
It states in part whether the a parent in a termination of parental rights case, when that happens and enters a no contest plea, et cetera, and it points out if the plea colloquy in that fails to inform the, better stated, miscommunicates, you said, miscommunicates the burden it is required to apply at disposition. So miscommunicates the burden. In some ways, when I read that, when miscommunicates the burden, inherent or implicit in that question is a determination, is there a burden? Or if it miscommunicates the burden, what is the burden, right? You have to have a threshold before you can, against which you can measure if there was a miscommunication.
Sure.
I assume that you received the letter last week of the guardian ad litem attaching the most recent decision generally addressing these matters in the HC case decided on March 5th. Does this opinion that's attached in the HC case, attached to the letter of the guardian ad litem, inform your argument as to whether or not the correct burden of proof was miscommunicated?
I did receive the letter with the HC case, so I am aware of that case, certainly. I happen to be the attorney on that case as well. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I could have applauded you, I guess.
Sure,
question.
I guess I would, to answer that question, I don't think that case has any impact on this case. As the statutes that control termination of parental rights cases and disposition in those cases, there is no burden of proof listed in the statute that's placed on the state.
But the judge there found, the Court of Appeals found that the burden of proof is preponderance of evidence. So it seems to me it implicates... at least implicates your argument here and implicates the question first addressed, whether or not there was a miscommunication of the burden of proof.
Well, I mean, I guess if the judge is correct in that decision and there is a preponderance of the evidence, I'm not sure there's any impact directly on this case because the court still would have miscommunicated the proper burden of proof, because the court here indicated that the burden of proof was clear and convincing evidence. I guess that's my first overall statement to your question. I also note that, you know, at this point, you know, that case is not binding law. And at the time of BW's plea, I think it was clear that there was no burden of proof in the statute. This is a discretionary decision that a circuit court makes, whether or not termination is appropriate based on the best interests of the child. And in essence, I guess it's a judgment call that the court makes, and there's no burden of proof that goes along with that. Based on the statute present when BW entered his plea, and frankly still right now.
So I haven't gone back and looked at every civil statute that there is. My guess is a lot of them don't have a burden of proof in the statute, yet we do have an understanding that the default burden of proof, the general burden of proof in a civil case, is preponderance of the evidence. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that, I believe there is at times a presumption that there is a preponderance of the evidence burden of proof in civil cases.
Right, it seems odd to me, your argument that there's no burden of proof, because it seems odd to me that you have two sides, and the case is not decided until the judge resolves the two issues. One is grounds, and one is disposition. So unlike sentencing, where it's already decided, unlike figuring out where placement is in a divorce case, although that one's a little murkier, but at that point, at least there's a divorce. Like here, the determination is not complete until those two phases are made, are done, the grounds and disposition. So after grounds, the rights aren't terminated yet. The person is still at risk of termination. So it seems odd to me that we would say there's no burden. What if the evidence is equal? What if the evidence... Like, what do you do? What would a judge do? What would the law say the judge does? Who's responsible for proving it, right? Isn't it the state? Isn't it always have to be the state in that circumstance when you're taking away the rights of a parent?
I guess my answer to that is, even if there is not a burden of proof, the judge still makes a decision in that second part. And the decision is similar to a criminal sentencing. The judge makes that decision based on their discretion, what they think is in the best interest of the child.
Counsel, you're not asking us to resolve the issue definitively in this case as to whether there is a burden of proof at disposition and termination of parental rights. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't.
With respect to the issues you actually have presented to the court, right?
I don't think it matters. And I think the burden of proof issue, you can kind of split it up two ways. The statute itself, I don't think, lists one. There might be a different question whether the statute there's a constitutional problem with the statute for not having one. But that's not an issue I've raised in this case. It's not an issue this court needs to resolve to determine this case. And I think the case can be decided based on the statute as it is, which doesn't list the burden of proof.
So let me just follow up, if I can, on my colleague's question. So you're saying in order to that for purposes of the mandatory duties of the trial court in a plea colloquy, no burden of proof need be communicated at all. And if one is not communicated, even if there is a burden of proof, that is preponderance or something like, none need to be communicated, right? So trial court should not, in their plea colloquy, state a burden of proof.
It's an interesting question, and it's a difficult one to answer because I don't think the trial court at this point should be communicating one at all because there isn't one in the statute. So any communication of a burden of proof is going to be problematic based on the statute as it is.
So the man in there's other ways to withdraw pleas too, right? You know, manifest injustice or those sorts of things.
Sure.
So, the main argument you want us to take away is that the mandatory duties of the trial court are to follow what the statute says. Statute does communicate a burden of proof for the grounds phase, doesn't communicate a burden of proof for the disposition phase. If the trial court does that, it hasn't violated a mandatory duty, therefore no prima facie case, regardless of whether there is some default and or constitutional reason why there should be a burden placed on this. At you. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's fair. Sure.
If we disagree with your argument, really does hinge upon the fact that there obviously was communicated a clear and convincing standard. And if we didn't agree that that was an accurate reading of the record, you're comfortable with saying there was no violation of any mandatory duty because no burden of proof is communicated, and that would have been consistent with the statute.
If you read the record to say that the court didn't communicate any sort of burden of proof, which is not how I read the record, I disagree.
Correct. I understand
with that.
That's your argument. Right? Yep.
I would agree there wouldn't be a problem here. I mean, it is contingent on the court miscommunicating the clear and convincing burden of proof.
Let me ask a follow-up. You know, obviously one of the concerns we have is any decision we make in this case needs to at least it's somewhat implicitly addressed what is required at the, to be communicated during a plea colloquy. So let's say trial court is reading Judge Colon's decision or some other judges who have assumed there is some burden of proof. Is it error for trial court to communicate a preponderance standard at the disposition phase in your view? I mean, my concern at this point is providing clear guidance as well to what trial courts need to do when they're giving pleas here. I assume, obviously, given your role, that's something you would be concerned with as well.
I do, and I think as I've argued in my briefs, I don't think there is a burden of proof. The statute doesn't list one. And so I think communicating that there is one, whether it be preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing evidence, which is worse, that is a problem.
So you don't think due process requires one?
I think that's a different argument, certainly. And I guess what I can say to that is that BW has not raised a constitutional challenge to the statute here. And I have not challenged that the statute is unconstitutional for not having a burden of proof in it. Do I think that's a potential question, and that's a question that the HC case would address? Yes, but that's not an issue that I'm raising in this case.
But do you see the problem here that we're in? Because if, and I don't know how I feel about this,
sure,
let alone my colleagues, but if we were to say, as you're asking us to, that there was a problem here because clear and convincing was miscommunicated as a burden, but then we in HC are now talking about the constitutional claim and we decide that clear and convincing is the burden, we're like contradicting ourselves. So the two things are connected. How do we just say, you represent your client. You want the simple thing you're asking for your client, but it puts us in a spot. Because if we say, well, statutorily there's none, and so therefore it was wrong, but later we say it was clear and convincing, it would have been right to have communicated that, right?
I understand what you're saying, that there's some conflict between the two cases. And I guess the best answer I can give you is, at least as it relates to this case, let's say later on this court determines that preponderance of the evidence is the burden. I don't know if that determination would be made because court determines it's somehow built into the statute already, or if it's a constitution issue that requires it. If that's the determination, it doesn't impact this case because the court would have still given the incorrect burden.
And you haven't briefed any of these issues that the court is posing to you today, right?
No.
I feel like you're at a bit of a disadvantage because you're arguing to us a different case than the questions coming from the court, right? Because I don't think anyone could make an argument that clear and convincing would be the burden of proof. We have an unpublished Court of Appeals opinion that recently came down saying it's preponderance of the evidence. But your argument is centered on the premise that whether it's preponderance of the evidence or whether there isn't a burden, it isn't clear and convincing, so the circuit court made an error. Is that the crux of your argument?
That is the crux of my argument.
Go ahead, Chief.
If the court were to decide burden of proof today or in the future based upon the arguments made in your brief and here today, wouldn't you want the opportunity to be able to brief that issue and potentially argue that issue prepared differently than you are today?
I absolutely would want that potential because that isn't an issue I've raised in this case. It is
right.
An issue I've raised.
I understood your issue raised as Justice Rebecca Bradley did, and that is you don't need to decide the burden of proof, but if it's miscommunicated by the court, we get to withdraw this and start over, kind of. And if this were centered on what the proper burden of proof is, if there is one, by the way, I would think you'd want the chance to fully vet that.
That's correct. I would, more so than we have up until this point in the briefing.
Can we turn to what you did brief? Are you ready?
Let's give it a shot.
Okay. I just want you to this is the way I'm doing it, and I want I just want you to help me understand a little better. At the initial appearance, it's pretty clear the trial court did say that the state would have to prove by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence that it's in the child's best interest that the court could terminate your parental rights, right? So that clear and convincing standard happened at the IA, which was on June 28th of 2021. About 9 months later, March 2nd, in the plea colloquy at the hearing that's at issue in this case, the judge says, but either way, it's the state's burden to prove by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence to a reasonable certainty that grounds exist. So first she's talking about the grounds phase, and I think we all agree that that was fine. Yes?
That's correct.
Okay. Then she says, now, that does not mean, and there's a little bit, I'm skipping ahead just a couple sentences. Now, that does not mean you're giving up your trial rights to the second half of the case, and that's what we call disposition. That's all okay. Yes?
Yes, those are trial rights at disposition. I agree.
Okay. And at that hearing, the court would have to decide if it's in the child's best interest to actually terminate your parental rights.
Yes.
And all those same trial rights that you would have again in that second half is just a trial to the judge in that second half. So your argument is that the judge stated that the burden in the second half was the clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence. I'm just not seeing that. What am I missing?
Sure. So what the judge says is all of those rights that I just discussed you have, trial rights that I discussed that you have in grounds, you have at disposition. And so what that statement means to me is that all the rights the court just listed and grounds, they have those same rights at disposition.
Is that a right?
Absolutely. I mean, a person has a right to make the state prove their case at grounds by clear and convincing evidence. That is a right. I cited it, I believe, in my reply brief in this case to the Brenda B. case that specifically talks about that the parent has to understand that they have the right to make the state prove by clear and convincing evidence that grounds exist. And so I understand the court did not, during the plea colloquy, specifically refer to the clear and convincing burden at grounds as a right, but it is a right, no matter what the court calls it. And so when the court says you have all those rights that I listed in grounds, it's necessarily referring to the burden of proof as well. The court's comment that you have the same trial rights, I mean, it has to have some sort of meaning, that the court didn't just say it without meaning. It was referring back to the rights the court listed that the person had at grounds.
I mean, I guess, I don't know, in AG, the judge did describe that evidentiary standard as a right.
Correct.
That didn't happen here.
Right.
So I guess you're saying that even if it hadn't happened in AG, if she didn't say right, it still would have been an issue?
I think using the word right is sort of a distinction without a difference. It is a right. You don't have to use sort of the magic word right to make it one. And so when the court says you have all those same rights, it's necessarily referring to that burden of proof during grounds. I don't think there's much difference between – actually, I really don't think there's any difference between the colloquy in AG and here because of that.
And are you looking only at the colloquy, or are you looking at the adjourned initial appearance as well to make your prima facie case?
So the – I understand that the prima facie case is based on the colloquy. That's where the mistake has to happen. But it's really important that this is just a prima facie case that BW has to make. We're not further along in the Bangert analysis. And so I think when you look at this colloquy, BW's and my assertion that the court told him he had this right to make the state prove by clear and convincing evidence at disposition. I believe that that is a reasonable interpretation of the record. And that reasonable interpretation of the record makes the prima facie case. I think the fact that the court also made this mistake at the initial appearance adds to the reasonableness of that assessment. And the push towards him making a prima facie case. At the end of the day, I understand that the actual mistake has to happen at the plea colloquy, and for the reasons here, I do think that mistake did take place.
I just want to make sure I zero down on what you're asking us to say. Obviously, the question of whether there is a burden here is not, in some sense, directly raised, but the question that is directly raised is what needs to be communicated during a plea colloquy with regard to a burden.
Sure.
And your argument is no burden should be communicated.
Because there isn't one.
Because there isn't one in the statute. And that's what you want us to communicate. If we were writing a decision in your favor, you would say, or even not in your favor, depending on how we read the record, you would want us to say, as a matter of clarity, the statute does not provide a burden. And in the plea colloquy, none should be communicated, and it was error to communicate one.
Correct. It was error for the court to communicate a burden, the clear and convincing burden, because there isn't one. And, you know, the reason why I think that's problematic is that parents sort of need to know how the court is going to make its decision at disposition. That's sort of what a lot of these cases that I cited to my brief, like the Therese S. case and Brenda B. talk about, is that parents need to know how the court is going to pick the disposition. And if the court says that there's this higher burden, like clear and convincing burden, they've completely miscommunicated to the parent how they're going to make their decision at disposition. They've frankly given the parents a belief that their chances of sort of success, of not having their child's rights terminated, are greater than they actually are, because there isn't a burden.
Counsel, part of your argument seems premised on pointing out that if there is no burden in the statute for a cause of action like a TPR, then there is no burden. And I say, whew, I mean, that's quite a spelled P-H-F-F-F. That's quite a statement. I see all of these law students. When I was in law school, I worked at Consumer Protection in DOJ. And so I grabbed this morning, as you were making your arguments, 100.18 and 100.20, which deals with causes of action for false, misleading, and deceptive advertising. I couldn't find a burden at all, just as an example. So your statement seems awfully broad, that premised on something that may be incorrect. If a statute setting forth a cause of action doesn't contain a burden, then there is no burden?
Well, I mean, I guess my statement's not, I guess, more or less me just, you know, making this up. You know, as I've said, it's in the statute. but also, there's cases from this court that explain that the decision at disposition is simply a discretionary decision that's made by the court and has not found a burden.
If anything, generally I try to be a bit realistic, look reality in the face and deal with it.
My red light's on. I just want to point that out. I'm not trying to run away.
Assuming I'm reality, you're lucky you can sit down. I'll save my question
okay,
later.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Phew.
Yeah, I know. P-H-E-W.
This is my moment of kindness, and that's it.
Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Jenny Spies-Garris, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. I will be splitting my time evenly with the guardian ad litem. We both intend to use 15 minutes to present our case. My first point, a plea and a termination of parental rights case should be valid as long as the trial court complies with Wisconsin Statute 48.422 sub 7, in all relevant case law concerning the standard of proof at a dispositional hearing. This is exactly what Justice Hagendorn was just saying, and the state urges the court to make that the law and the decision in this case. As long as the plea follows what's outlined in Wisconsin Statute 48.422 sub 7, that the admission was voluntary, that the parent understood the allegations in the petition, the possible dispositions, that there were no threats or promises, and there's a factual basis for the petition, as well as the case law that's been previously in place, specifically looking at Brenda B. and Therese S., and that talks about whether or not there was an unfitness finding, and the parent understood that they can be found unfit, and what the standard of proof is, or what the best interest is, the standard at the dispositional hearing.
Counsel, you mentioned Brenda B. Brilliant decision written in 2011.
You're on a roll.
Yeah, I don't know. but in that decision, the majority indicated the following, when there was a plea of no contest, that in pleading no contest, let me get the quote here, in the grounds phase of a TPR proceeding, the parent gives up, quote, the right to make the petitioner prove unfitness by clear and convincing evidence. So it's your position that with regard to the grounds phase, it is a trial right to be advised. Let me ask, is it your position that in the grounds phase, it is a trial right to be advised of the burden of proof?
It is a trial right that they are giving up, correct. But it is not the dispositional. Like, so they're giving up the right to have the state prove by clear and convincing evidence at the grounds phase. And that is what he was advised in this case. So they are giving that right up. They're also giving the right to be found unfit, the right to an attorney, the right to the jury trial. They're explained as to the disposition. So that is, and the standard at the disposition. And they're explained that the best interest is the standard of proof. And that is explained to them so that they understand what the options are at the disposition. So they.
Is there a difference between standard of proof and burden of proof?
The standard of proof is explained to them. And the reason that's explained is so that they understand what the meanings of the dispositions are.
You're talking in general terms, right? So as I understand Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's question, I think she asked you, is that best interest of a child, is that a trial right?
The best interest of a child is not a trial right. No, that's the right at the disposition. I guess I'm confused by the question.
Well, it's confusing because if you look at the I think this just goes back to what the judge says at the transcript, and she says you will have the same rights. And I think what Justice Ann Walsh Bradley was getting at is when she said, I think what she was asking about that, is that a right? When she says all the same trial rights, right, that's the crux of this case. Right? Does that include that, I guess we're calling it either a standard or a burden? A standard or a burden of proof? Or I think you're calling it a standard because it's the best interest of the child standard as opposed to a preponderance of the evidence burden of proof.
I would not call, in this case, the explanation the burden of proof. I would not call it a trial right. Based on the explanation to the court. That is the way the trial court determined it. And that is the way the Court of Appeals determined it in the reading and the explanation to
when
the
you
W.
Say determined it. I'm not quite following.
So, when establishing whether or not BW made the prima facie case, and in looking at the transcript in the explanation to BW, the trial court found that BW had not made the prima facie case because the explanation and given to him. They found that it had not been described as a right. That is what the trial court found. That is what the Court of Appeals found. I understand that this court is not bound by the findings of the trial court or the Court of Appeals, but I think that is a reasonable expectation and reading of the record that the state's, if you look at the specific transcript, it describes the state's burden to prove by clear and convincing and satisfactory evidence to a reasonable degree that grounds exist. And then it goes on to describe a number of more specific rights, the right to subpoena, the right to require witnesses, the right to testify yourself. So more procedural rights as opposed to burdens, the state's burden. So in this situation, the trial court and the Court of Appeals found that that was not described as a right. The state believes that's a reasonable reading of the record and that as a result, BW did not make a prima facie case. As I said, this court is not bound by that reading, but I think that is a reasonable reading, and I would ask the court to find that in this situation that BW did not establish a prima facie case. If the court is not willing to make that record or make that finding, I would urge the court to also look at State versus Taylor and specifically look at the insubstantial defect line of cases. Because I think if you look at State versus Taylor, which is something the court did look at in AG, and to require an evidentiary hearing
for every small deviation for a circuit court's duties during a plea colloquy is simply not necessary to protect a defendant's constitutional rights.
Counsel, just to make sure, I just want to understand, I heard you say this, I think I heard you say this, I just want to be on the same page. You agree with your opposing counsel, just in terms of the rubric that we're going to use to decide this case. Now, the trial court, when it's mandatory duties for the plea colloquy for our purposes here, are to follow the statutory language and to not communicate a burden, but simply communicate the statutory standard, best interest of the child, with regard to the disposition phase. Obviously, the grounds phase also does have a statutory burden of proof that's listed there as well. In that, if a trial court does that, no prima facie case has been made for purposes of plea withdrawal. Is that correct? I understand there's disputes about the record, but at least for our purposes here, we'll obviously address that question. But that's a less important question to me than what the rule is that we are going to communicate.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. The state believes that as long as the statute is followed and the standard of proof is communicated, that the plea is valid. The state also believes that, again, we have dispute as to whether or not in this case what was communicated, but the rule is there should be nothing communicated about burden of proof during the plea. The state also does agree with BW that in this case, this court does not need to decide the burden of proof to get to the decision in this case.
Let me ask you this. If this court were to venture into the burden of proof and making a determination, would you also want the chance to fully vet and argue that issue and brief it?
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor. Okay. We have not been able to fully brief that issue. The state's obviously also a party in State versus AC or HC. That's not my case, but I am very familiar with it as well. But we would absolutely want to fully brief it.
I'm trying to think of a time, you know, you look at, it's a criminal context probably, but not always. I mean, you have civil OWIs where the court is making discretionary determinations at a dispositional phase in a variety of cases where there's a burden of proof at the outset regarding whether the state or whoever has met their burden to prove something to get it to the point of a dispositional phase. But once it's at a dispositional phase, I'm trying to think back on divorces and other cases where you're dealing with custody situations, best interests of a child. I don't ever recall saying you've met beyond a preponderance of the evidence that placement should be here or this should happen. You always just talk in terms of best interests of the child. I'm thinking back on TPRs. I'm not convinced that burden of proof in discretionary dispositional phases, I'm trying to think of when that ever might occur. And I definitely would want the chance to search best interests of a child in the statutes to see how many times that comes up in a variety of scenarios where no burden of proof is stated. That's different than the initial charges or allegations and the burden of proof that has to be met by before it gets to the trial court's discretionary determination at disposition. Is that another way of stating what you're arguing?
It's very difficult because we haven't had a chance to brief it and look into all of those different issues.
Right, but my point isn't what the burden of proof is. It's when you get to a dispositional phase, that's not the same as the initial charging or allegation phase where there's a burden of proof. When the court has discretion in a dispositional phase, that's a different determination for which I'm not familiar with burdens of proof applying.
No, it's a very complicated. There's the six factors that we look at under 48.
Factors, that's different. Courts 427. They don't look at all the factors and things
right.
like that, even in best interest placement divorce proceedings. But.
And I'm not familiar as much with the family law because I've practiced primarily in the termination of parental rights proceedings. So
I just see this as potentially a much bigger issue if we're going to decide that there's a burden of proof in disposition in best interest.
Right. And this is a case that
absolutely can be decided without addressing the burden of proof. This case can be decided whether or not there's a burden of proof is not really the issue in this case.
So you're asking us to make a very narrow decision, basically whether or not a prima facie case was made. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And if you look at this case procedurally, BW has failed to meet that burden of proof at the prima facie case. BW established a very interesting hypothetical question in his petition, but the facts in his case simply do not support the arguments that he is making. BW was never misadvised in the colloquy about the burden of proof at the disposition. It is the state's contention, if you look at the language in that colloquy, that the burden of proof, when the court goes through it, the court describes it as the state's burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence. It never talks about a right. This is kind of building on the argument that we have from State versus AG, but we're at a very different procedural posture than State versus AG. We had State versus AG where the court very specifically called the burden of proof a right and then referred back to rights. So if we really didn't have that State versus AG, I don't think we would have this case where we're building on that inference. We had a very strained inference in State versus AG by referring back to those same rights.
So it's basically your position that when she talks about the dispositional phase, the judge here isn't talking about the burden of proof at all.
No.
It's not like we don't need to talk about your argument, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that we don't need to talk about the burden of proof because it's not even at issue here reading this transcript, because it was discussed with respect to the dispositional or with the grounds phase, but it wasn't discussed at all with respect to the dispositional phase.
Correct. My reading of this transcript is that the court was only referring to the grounds phase when she talked about the clear and convincing the state's burden of proof. And the alternative argument, again, as I had been talking about before, was if this court is willing or feels that there was an inference, again, which the state is not conceding, the state would urge the court to look at State versus Taylor and that insubstantial defect. Specifically, it's important to note that BW was never giving up his right to the dispositional hearing. The plea colloquy is about ensuring that the parent knows what he is giving up in that plea. He was never giving up his right to that contested dispositional hearing at any point. Oh, I see my time's up. Can I finish my sentence?
Yes.
Okay. So even a misstatement of that burden of proof at the plea, potential misstatement of burden of proof at the plea colloquy would be an insubstantial defect. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Courtney Rolance, and I am the guardian ad litem in this case, representing the minor child's best interests. This case is about prioritizing the function of a plea colloquy over the form by which it is conducted. I have 2 points. First, on behalf of the minor child, we are asking this Court to resolve the split decisions of the Court of Appeals and answer whether informing a parent of the standard of proof, the child's best interests, is sufficient to comply with statutory duties, or whether giving extraneous information on the unresolved burden of proof renders a plea involuntary. We respectfully request that this court rule that advising a parent on the standard of proof is sufficient to comply with statutory standards. Second, we are asking this court to hold that the trial court did not erroneously exercise its discretion when it analyzed the third dispositional factor under Wisconsin Statute 48.426, sub 3, sub C, because to find otherwise imposes magic words on the circuit court when considering promises of post-TPR contact. When I conclude, I will ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals. There are a few things that I think we should put on the table outright. First, this case is in a different procedural posture than State versus AG. This case, unlike AG, is about whether BW made a prima facie case. We are not discussing the totality of the circumstances. And second, BW had a fully contested dispositional hearing. This case is about a perceived defect concerning a portion of the case that BW did not waive his rights to by entering a plea. Turning to my first point, there is no defect in the plea colloquy itself, and therefore BW did not make a prima facie case that he should be entitled to withdraw his plea. This court in 2007 in State versus Howell found that a Bangert motion, a prima facie case, is determined on the plea colloquy itself. Here, looking at the colloquy itself, there is no error. BW tries to assert the same error that or argument that was advanced in State versus AG. There are two problems with trying to pigeonhole this into AG. First, in AG, the case was in a different procedural posture. It was post-evidentiary hearing, and the law of the case doctrine presupposed that there was a defect. But second, and more specifically, in AG, the trial court told the parent that he had, quote, a whole bunch of rights, and listed them by starting off with saying he had the right to force the state to prove grounds by clear and convincing evidence.
Counsel, just to make sure and get this squared away, are you in agreement with your two friends here that with the general rubric that we've talked about, that the trial court's obligation in a plea, in this context, mandatory duties, is simply to state the statutory standard, not communicate a burden of proof. And if the trial court does so, it is not a violation of their mandatory duties, and no prima facie case has been stated. I think both of your colleagues have indicated their agreement with that principle. Again, how it applies here, different question, but I just want to make sure that we're on the same page. That's the principle you're advocating as well.
Yes, Your Honor, I am. And to address some of the concerns from the other justices, I do think it's a stopgap. But until there is a resolution or a published decision on the burden of proof, that's the only thing the trial court can do. There's no consensus on whether there is a burden of proof, and there's no controlling law on what it is. I understand this case came through, I think it was 2 weeks ago, but as of today, there's no way for a trial court to consistently advise on anything but the child's best interests at this point or that standard of proof.
Thank you.
I want to address some of the questions that were posed by this side of the bench. I guess about if it matters, the standard of proof, the burden of proof, whether or not this is a trial right or not. The purpose of a plea colloquy is that a parent understands the stakes involved in the case. That was kind of the big holding of Brenda B., that the parent has sufficient information to evaluate the stakes involved. And there's a lot in these cases of going back and forth on, did we call it a right? Is it a right? Here, the court didn't call it a right, and BW is not a lawyer. He has not read these cases. BW listened to the court say, in fact, say, either way, it's the state's burden to prove by clear and convincing and satisfactory evidence to a reasonable certainty that the grounds exist. And the state would do that by calling witnesses to the stand. They would testify under oath. You would have a right to cross-examine them and the right to introduce your own evidence, the right to use subpoenas to require witnesses to come to the court and testify for you, and also the right to testify yourself or remain silent. And then a few lines later, now that doesn't mean you're giving up your trial rights to the second half. I think here what the court is tasked with doing in deciding the prima facie case is not look to see if we can parse out an error, but look at the effect of it. BW heard strategy listed as rights, subpoenaing witnesses, cross-examining witnesses.
Hold it.
I mean, is it your position that in the grounds phase, there is no right to cross-examine witnesses, to call witnesses to testify on your behalf, a right to make the state prove its case by evidence that is clear, satisfactory, and convincing? Is it your position those rights don't exist at the ground phase?
They absolutely exist at the grounds phase. I think what the court in a plea colloquy is trying to communicate in terms that are more broadly understood what's going on in a complicated legal proceeding. And so I think, pursuant to Brenda B., the court was making sure that BW understood there was a burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence at the grounds phase.
A right to that, be told.
Yes, but didn't tell him specifically it was a right. And then kind of went through these things about you have the right to call witnesses, you have the right to testify. What BW heard was those strategy type rights, called rights, and then told you have those rights later. I don't know that BW sitting in that courtroom that day would have not heard the burden of proof not listed as a right and inferred that it was one. And that's what I'm getting at.
Well, then you read directly from the record 63-5, where the court started that but either way language.
Yes.
And that was referring to the grounds.
Correct.
And then later the court says, now that doesn't mean you're giving up your trial rights to the second half. That's what we call disposition. And at that hearing, the court would have to decide if it's in the child's best interest to actually terminate your parental rights.
Yes. So I don't think that there is a defect here, but nonetheless, this issue continues to arise for increasingly weak differences in the appellate courts. And earlier, Justice Rebecca Bradley asked, does HC matter? And it does, though I still don't think the court needs to decide the burden of proof today. However, I'm also on HC, so I do know the case a bit. On March 5th, the Court of Appeals for District 1 issued this unpublished decision on what the burden of proof is. And while this court is not beholden to that opinion, TPR jurisprudence in the state of Wisconsin is almost exclusively handled in unpublished cases. Until the legislature or this court take up an issue, generally speaking, trial courts are handling the day-to-day through unpublished case law. And so trial judges in real time have to adjust their decision-making in anticipating what the Court of Appeals is going to rule on the next case. Unpublished decisions are how trial judges discern what the law is until this court or the legislature say otherwise. And so while this court is not beholden to that decision in State versus HC, and while we haven't briefed it here and this probably isn't the case to decide it, the court here has an opportunity to give clear direction on what trial courts are supposed to do in the meantime.
And what is that in the meantime? That we're to give the clear direction on. That's consistent with the statute and ultimately the Constitution.
Your Honor, I do think that this court should hold that advising a parent on that standard of proof, the child's best interests, this court should find that that is sufficient to comply with statutory requirements until there is published guidance on the burden of proof at TPR disposition.
Will you get to your second point, your second question that we haven't talked about that issue yet? You're running out of time.
Sure. But turning to my second point, this court should not extend the existing requirements under Margaret H. to require magic words in discussing that post-TPR contact promises are unenforceable. BW concedes that this court decisively ruled that trial courts can consider the statements of a proposed adoptive parent that they will continue contact after the legal relationship with a biological family member is severed. This court did not require there, and it should not require here, that a trial court utter magic words in order to exercise its discretion appropriately. This court shouldn't change that position. A trial court should not be required to ruminate on the enforceability of a promise or a testimony that post-TPR contact would continue. the purpose of this factor or that case is really to assess, like, does it exist? Is it credible? If it's credible, will it mitigate harm to the child if that contact continues? BW seems to have two concerns in this area. One is the use of the word co-parenting by the trial court. And the second is the lack of considering the harm or ruminating on it in the decision. As to the first concern, BW has a daughter with the proposed adoptive resource. He literally co-parents with her. There is an existing legal relationship that makes him a co-parent with the proposed adoptive resource. The trial court looked at that and found it to be extremely reliable or credible information or evidence that continued contact would continue between BW and the child here due to that legal relationship that otherwise exists. And the court found that it would mitigate harm, which goes to the second point. Mitigation is only a consideration if there would be harm. If there's no harm, there's nothing to mitigate. The trial court reflecting and deciding that it would be a mitigating factor to continue that relationship was the court considering that the child has a substantial relationship with BW, that severing it would cause harm, but it would be mitigated by that continued contact that is extremely reliable to happen because BW co-parents with DD, the foster parent. Ultimately, though, all of the factors do not have to weigh in favor for TPR to be in a child's best interests. The most important factor in this case, per the trial court, was subfactor 3F, permanence. And the court is allowed to do that. The court found that the most important factor for this child was stability and permanence. So the trial court did not erroneously exercise its discretion. Really, the trial court did exactly what this court wanted trial courts to be able to do in Margaret H., which is to look at the family situation, look at that family dynamic, and determine whether or not it was in the child's best interest moving forward to have contact or not.
You acknowledge, though, that that kind of maintaining of a relationship is unenforceable.
Yes. And I would note that in voluntary TPR colloquies, it is very often discussed heavily that it's unenforceable. What the distinction here being that I would urge this court to not require a trial court to ruminate on the record about the unenforceability to still find that the court has properly exercised its discretion.
I'm not sure what you mean by ruminate.
Essentially,
tell them it's not unenforceable. Is that ruminating?
So
it's not enforceable, rather?
A decision isn't necessarily a colloquy, and so it's not really telling the parent in a decision. It would be the court noting on the record, well, this is unenforceable, but... And I just don't know that that's required in the full context for a court itself to properly exercise its discretion.
So court doesn't have to say it's unenforceable, doesn't have to consider that it's unenforceable? Don't you think the court should consider it?
Certainly the court should consider that. Oh, and I see I'm out of time. May I finish my thought?
You may finish the sentence, yeah.
Thank you. Certainly the court needs to consider that it's unenforceable. However, requiring a formulaic, I'm sorry, I can't think of the word, some kind of magic words, requiring magic words on the record of the court saying, now I know this is unenforceable, but I don't think that is required for the court to have considered that this could be a mitigating factor. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
I wanted to first address a couple issues related to issue one in the case, and then hopefully have some time to talk about issue two. looking at the court's colloquy here and whether or not there was a problem, I believe that for this court to find that the plea colloquy was not problematic, the court would have to determine that making the state prove grounds by clear and convincing evidence is not a trial right. And I don't think that's accurate. When a parent goes to trial, the state has to prove grounds by clear and convincing evidence. That's a right a parent has. And I don't think we can call it anything but that. And you don't need to call it a right to make it a right. You know, if the court here, when it was talking about cross-examining and calling witnesses, just didn't use the word right, it wouldn't make those non-rights. I mean, those are rights too, whether the court calls it one or not. And so here, when the court says you have all those same rights I just talked about, when I was talking about grounds at disposition, it has to be referring to the clear and convincing burden of proof as well. So that's my first point in response to the state and the guardian ad litem. The other thing I wanted to point out is the state had mentioned that, you know, if the court miscommunicates that there's a burden of proof, that this is potentially some kind of insubstantial defect. And I don't think that it is. I think it's actually a very important, very substantial defect. Because if there is no burden of proof and the court tells a parent that there is one and it's much higher, the parent has no idea of the parent's chances of success at the dispositional phase.
Counsel, if you were writing this opinion for the court, give me an outline of what your opinion would state.
Sure. If I'm writing this for the court, I think what the court should say is that BW has presented a reasonable reading of the record here, which shows that the court miscommunicated that there was a clear and convincing burden of proof at disposition. And because of that miscommunication, and because the court is required to tell the parent what the actual statutory standard is, he's made a prima facie case, and this court needs to remand for an evidentiary hearing.
How can we say as a court that there was a miscommunication of the clear and convincing? Miscommunication of the burden without underlying analysis of why it's a miscommunication. So in your outline, it is a miscommunication because there is no burden? Is that what you want
That's
us
correct.
To write? Woo. And then we get another case and we say, oh, yes, there is a burden. I mean, that's like whiplash for our circuit court judges. This is a bread and butter issue. And I'm concerned that we place our trial judges and the litigants who come before them in an untenable position.
Sure.
There is no burden, except there is a burden. Are you just asking for error correction here? What's going on? I mean, it's very unsettling to me.
I don't think I'm asking for error correction, and I guess if the court does think we have to make some sort of concrete decision about the burden of proof, I mean, that's something that maybe further briefing and argument about might be appropriate. I guess the window in which it matters in this case is probably pretty small. I mean, the court would have to determine that there's actually a clear and convincing burden of proof at disposition for it to impact BW's case, right? Because that's the disposition the court used.
So we could say we don't know if there's a burden, but if there is one, it's not clear and convincing.
I guess you could. I guess I just keep struggling with this, that at the time BW entered his plea, there was not a burden of proof in the statute. My light's up. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right.
Interesting oral arguments this morning. It was nice having the law school here with us today. We will adjourn now, and the courtroom will